Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to film sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
There, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to dip into the archives. Full disclosure, I'm in a play that is opened this weekend, depending on when you're listening to the show. I'm in a production of Dracula, which is happening at Richmond Civic Theater in Richmond, Indiana. You can go to gorct.org for ticket information. I'm playing Professor Van Helsing, which has been a lot of fun, but it runs this weekend. So if you're listening to this on Saturday, we have a performance Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. And then the following Friday and Saturday evenings at 7:30 p.m. plus a 2 p.m. matinee on Sunday the 28th. So if you want to go to church, have brunch, and watch Dracula, you can do that if you drive out to Wayne County. So anyway, I have not seen anything new recently. And we will go into the archives because this coming Tuesday, Shout Factory is releasing a Blu-ray edition of the fun Barry Sonnenfeld drama comedy, crime comedy, Get Shorty, based on the Elmore Leonard novel. So it's a good excuse to play my fun chat with the great Elmore Leonard, one of my favorite writers, if not my favorite writer. I don't do lists unless I'm paid. Anyway, we'll get to that in a little bit. So also, want to say a big shout out and thanks last week for Sammy Terry to be on the show. Of course, it's that time of year for him. So you go to SammyTerry.com for all the appearances. If you're listening to this on Saturday, you can check him out at the Bloomington Starlight outside the drive-in at 6 o'clock. On October 26th, he'll be at the Indiana Landmark Stage Show as well as a screening of the film Frankenstein. And at the Moonlight Drive-In on October the 27th. Plus, he'll be at ISU on October 29th, hosting a stage version of Frankenstein. And then, of course, he'll be online on Facebook and on SammyTerry.com on Halloween night, starting at 8 o'clock. A little bit of insight on when working on a show like Dracula. I have this little ritual that I do, whether I'm acting or directing, and especially in a case like this, is I can't watch any film version of the show I'm working on. Now, there is one exception that Ian Kinder, who plays Dr. Seward in this production, he and I watched Blackula and Scream Blackula Scream because he had not seen them, and I enjoy the hell out of them. And by the way, many times on this program, if you're a longtime film sociology listener, I've defended the film Blackula and Scream Blackula Scream. If anything else, because of the great performance of William Marshall in both of those, Ian pointed out how close, he was impressed with how close the original Blackula kept to the Bram Stoker story, so take that. But I will be watching probably some Dracula films, obviously, after the show is done and, of course, getting up for Halloween. But there's a cool thing that happens with, at least with me, and I hope others have this experience, and I use the example of when I acted in Much Ado About Nothing. The week after that play closed, this was about 4 or 5 years ago, I sat down on a Sunday morning, made a pot of coffee, and I watched the Kenneth Branagh film version of a film that I adore. I remember seeing it with a bunch of friends from college. It was the summer I had graduated from college, and a bunch of Ball State Theater students invading the Castleton Art Theater to watch Much Ado About Nothing. And it's a film I've watched probably 20 times. And then I sat down and watched it after playing Benedict, and my point of view, my experience with this film changed. It's forever changed now. And it's a great example of the art doesn't change, you change. Unless you're Spielberg or George Lucas and you're tinkering with your work. But anyway, because I had my own experience with this story, I had my own time with this character. And it doesn't make the film better or worse. And I wasn't sitting there with my arms crossed taking notes and saying, oh, that, you know, he did it that way, I did it this way, or you're talking about the adaptation. It's none of that. But because of having your own experience with the story, that, and I thought that was really, really cool. And I've said before, for instance, a film like The Big Chill should be watched every 5 years because as we get older, we have more life experience. The film is still the same, but you change and you might relate to things differently. You might you see things in a different light. I always ask people, especially my age, now that you're more of an adult age than a teen, closer to it, obviously you're in adult ages and no longer a teenager, do you still like Ferris Bueller as a person? So just little things like that. So I have a lot of Dracula films in my collection, whether it's the original Universal and Blackula. And I haven't watched Coppola's version of Bram Stoker's Dracula in years. And I can't wait to visit that because I've had my own experience with this story. So anyway, it's been a lot of fun working on this play in the shameless plug department. GoRCT.org for tickets. Next tonight at 7:30, next Friday and Saturday evening at 7:30 p.m., as well as a 2 p.m. matinee on Sunday, the 28th. All right, let's see what else is playing around the state. Don't forget, at Keystone Arts tonight at midnight, you can check out Evil Dead 2, Dead by Dawn. Yes, Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi. And then October 26th and 27th, if you can't make it to Wayne County, a 4K digital restoration, 30th anniversary of Tim Burton's Beetlejuice. So fun stuff. And this reminds me, and I've not forgotten, I promise, and I don't like using the word promise, even though I'm a dad, I still need to take my daughter to a midnight movie. The last time Keystone Arts played Beetlejuice, Emma really wanted to go, and she was, I think, 10. And I was uncertain because I told her, if I look over at 12:20 and you're asleep in your chair, I'm not going to be pleased. So we had this moment. It was in the winter. I use these moments. I call it pop culture Atticus Finch. But I said, you need to watch, if you want to go to a midnight movie, you need to watch a midnight movie at home. And if you stay up for it, then we'll try to. And I'm still trying to fulfill that commitment. So it was a very snowy, it was in the winter. We stayed at my in-law's place for the weekend because of the weather. And I got off the air on that Saturday night, went to the in-laws, and there was Emma. It was about 10:30, and Emma said, I want to take the test. And I always bring a bag of movies with me. Yeah, I'm that guy. And I said, pick one out. And she picked Pulp Fiction. Yes, I watch Tarantino films with my daughter. We're fine. But we waited until midnight, and we started Pulp Fiction. And then at 2:45 a.m., we got up out of the couch. She really, really liked the film. However, she grabbed my wrist and she said, walk me through it. And what she meant was she wanted to know what's the chronological order. She wanted to know the timeline for those stories. So anyway, every time I think of Beetlejuice, I think I have to take my daughter to a midnight movie. So, and maybe you can on October 26th and 27th at Keystone Arts. Over at IU Cinema, if you're listening to this on Saturday, you have a chance to run down at 4 o'clock and see 1968 Ingmar Bergman's film Shame. And then at 7 o'clock, the documentary The Queen of Ireland is a part of the Irish Pride, Equality in Ireland film series. On Sunday, the 21st, at 1 o'clock, the 1966 comedy The Trouble with Angels. And at 4 o'clock, the 2012 documentary The Fade. On Monday, the 22nd, at 7 o'clock, the 2014 documentary about the Olympic Russian hockey team, Red Army. On Thursday, the 25th, recently added at 10 p.m., the 1998 comedy Black Cat, White Cat, and filmmaker Boots Riley is scheduled to present the film. And Boots is going to be speaking on Friday, the 26th. Apparently, according to cinema.indiana.edu, IU Cinema will recognize a line at 5 p.m. on Friday, the 26th, and seat patrons as space is available. So Boots Riley will be there at 7 o'clock. And then recently had, at 10 o'clock, Paul Schrader's Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters. And Boots Riley will present that film as well. Sunday, the 27th at 4 p.m., a horror thriller double feature of The Hitchhiker and the Twilight Zone episodes The Mask. And then at 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 27th, as a part of the International Art House series, the 2017 drama Blew My Mind, B-L-U-E. Sunday, the 28th, at 1 o'clock, the 1931 film Frankenstein, and then Blew My Mind at 4 o'clock. Monday, the 29th, as a part of the East Asian film series, at 7 o'clock, the U.S. theatrical premiere of the 1938 horror film The Ghost Cat and the Mysterious Shamisen. Thursday, November 1st at 7 o'clock, Coco. Saturday, November 3rd at 4 o'clock, Goldfinger. And at 7 o'clock, the 2018 documentary Love, Gilda. And Sunday, November 4th at 1 o'clock, The Sting. And at 4 o'clock, National Theater Live's King Lear. And then Monday, November 5th, my daughter's birthday, the 2018 documentary Monrovia, Indiana. And then Thursday, November 8th, Cooley High at 7 o'clock. Michael Schultz and co-producer Gloria Schultz are scheduled to present, the director Michael Schultz of Cooley High fame. And Michael Schultz will be speaking on Friday, November 9th at 7 o'clock with a 10 p.m. Screening of Crush Groove. And then Saturday, November 10th at 4 o'clock, Car Wash. Michael Schultz will be there. And then Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood at 7 o'clock on Saturday, November 10th. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In. Yes, I love the fact that the drive-ins are open in October. On screen one, we have First Man. Yes, Damien Chazelle's film with Ryan Gosling and Claire Foy. On screen two, Night School. First Man and Night School. On screen two, The Hate U Give and Bad Times at the El Royale. On screen three, yes, the new version of Halloween and Venom. Well, there you go. And on screen four, still there, Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween, and The House with a Clock in Its Walls. That is over at the Tibbs Drive-In, at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville. A double feature of the 1978 Halloween and the 2018 Halloween. That's at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville. At the Historic Art Craft Theater at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, Hocus Pocus. And then at 2 p.m. on Sunday, they're showing Hocus Pocus with an open captioned with American Sign Language interpreted pre-show activities. On Tuesday, October 23rd, a free screening at 7 o'clock of Bend It Like Beckham. Thursday, October 25th, Spirits and Stage. I believe this is a radio play that's happening on Thursday, October 25th. And then Friday and Saturday, October 26th and 27th, at the Historic Art Craft Theater, 2 and 7:30 p.m., a 35-millimeter print, Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein. Very cool. I remember seeing that in the theater when I was a kid, way, way back when. All right. New on Blu-ray this week. The big title is Ant-Man and the Wasp, which is a fun standalone picture with Paul Rudd of the Marvel Universe. So anyway, it's a good time. It's one of those that, like I said, it's a standalone. I believe my daughter enjoyed watching that. And you don't have to know the entire universe in order to follow along with it. Another packaging of The Big Lebowski. Another packaging of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I believe making its Blu-ray debut, we'll have to check, unless it's just new packaging, and it's perfect for this time of year. 1975's, it's a TV movie, but still very memorable. 1975's Trilogy of Terror with Karen Black. New packaging for Halloween 2 and Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. Of course, Halloween 3, nothing to do with the others. The documentary Whitney. On Criterion, they have Shampoo. Yes, the Hal Ashby film with Warren Beatty. Also on Blu-ray, and Ian, the gentleman who plays Seward in Dracula, he and I have talked about this film from 1972, Dracula AD 1972. Yes, Christopher Lee going after 70s hippies. Also on Blu-ray this week, Unfriended Dark Web, if you needed that sequel. Schlock from 1973. Ash vs. Evil Dead, the complete collection from 2015 through 2017. And I think that's... Oh, also on... Oh, these are just new packagings. Of Mallrats, two Mules for Sister Sarah. Oh, the Danny McBride film Arizona is also out on Blu-ray. Also want to mention, if you are into... I always say, you say if you're into music. I'm hoping everybody is into music. There is also a 40th anniversary special edition of Yes Songs. So this is from a 1972 Rainbow Theater concert. And then also got sent to me live at the Meltdown Festival from 2007, the live performance from Melanie. Very cool stuff there. And Shout Factory's also put out City Slickers on Blu-ray, which hopefully I'll give a report on that next week. As I said, this next Tuesday will be the Shout Factory Blu-ray release of Get Shorty. And I got a full disclosure. I got a copy of it, and I got to revisit Get Shorty last week. Very fun. John Travolta, when he had his post-Pulp Fiction resurgence. As Chili Palmer, of course, and a tight cast of Delroy Lindo, Rene Russo, Gene Hackman, Bette Midler, Dennis Farina. And it's, of course, a film based on the Elmore Leonard novel. And this was finally when Hollywood was getting Elmore Leonard's work done correctly. So with that in mind, I'm going to replay my classic chat with Elmore Leonard. Just a fun interview, and a man who meant a lot to me as a middle school kid, high school kid, reading his novels. So, ladies and gentlemen, my classic chat with Elmore Leonard. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is a writer that makes me proud to be a writer who grew up in Michigan. Elmore Leonard, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
Just
writing a book.
What are you working on right now?
Well, I'm writing a book based, well, it's a Raylan book, Raylan Who's in Justified.
Mm-hmm.
I've already written two books that he stars in, so I thought, what the heck, well, Justified is running, I might as well write another one, and maybe they can use some of it, which they are going to do a little bit here and there. But it's a novel. It's not really based on anything that they're doing on the show.
Have you enjoyed the show so far?
I think it's great. It's so amazing that it seems so lifelike. It's so realistic, the way they talk. I can't believe it.
Well, the source doesn't fall too far from the tree, sir.
Well, they did wear those little bracelets that said, well, what would Elmore do? You know, that was nice. That was,
right.
That was kind of...
Now, when you're creating characters, do you know ones, whether you're writing or when you finish, that you know you're going to use again in future books?
No, never. But at least I don't think about it.
Okay.
But I'll see, for example, I'll see a photograph in the newspaper, a couple of marshals standing in front of the federal courthouse in Miami, and the woman has a shotgun on her, well, the stock is on her hip, and she's holding it up at an angle, and she's good looking. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, I got to use her. No question about it. Or when I met the guy named Raylan, I was in, in Texas? Amarillo, I think. And I was giving a talk at a luncheon, a book company that, they're not a publishing company, but they provide the books to bookstores and so on. And I was introduced to this fellow who was going to introduce me, and he said, "Hi, I'm Raylan." I said, "Raylan, God, I got to use your name if it's okay." I said, "That's perfect," and I've used it twice.
Now, have people come out of the woodworks claiming that they were the inspiration for some of your characters in the past?
I haven't heard it. No.
Okay. The current crisis going on in Detroit, whether it's the government or that's money or the city declining, has that been inspiration for future work?
No. Uh-uh. No, but I use Detroit because I know it. I've been here since the fourth grade. There's a lot of activity, but it's a big, robust, rowdy town, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've always enjoyed it here. It's fallen on bad times. There's no question about that. There, the people who know how to make cars, they're still around, but they've moved out to suburbs. There are about 900,000 people living in Detroit. But all the suburbs are bustling, and that's where they live. But I just heard today that it's going to be tougher for auto workers who don't have necessary skills. That it's going to be different now in the area of manufacturing. They're going to have to learn a new way of doing things. So I don't know. I suppose they will. You know what happened to all the blacksmiths? I'm sure they got a job
eventually. If you don't mind me asking, what part of town do you live on?
I live out in Bloomfield Village, which is, 16 miles north of Detroit.
Yes.
Well, the line, the Detroit line is at 8 Mile, and we're at, we live just north of 15, near 16 Mile Road.
Well, going back a little bit, what were some of the movies you watched growing up, and did they have any inspiration to you when it became when you wanted to be a writer?
Yes, one in particular, All Quiet on the Western Front, and it was released in 1931. I saw it; it kept coming back. This was before television, but I saw it at least twice in movie theaters. And I was inspired in the fifth grade to write a play. That was 1935. And I wrote a World War I play where the Germans were on one side of the classroom and the Americans were on the other, and one of the Americans crawls under the desk, which is no man's land, and gets caught and gets shot, and somebody has to go out and save him. And I think it was the coward of the outfit who goes out and saves them. I'm not sure now. I wish I had that script. It'd be valuable. But we put it on one performance in the classroom. And that was it. So our teacher, the sister who was our homeroom, well, we were always in the same room,
mm-hmm.
and the mother superior of the school came and watched it, and that was it. That was the first thing I'd ever written, I didn't write really anything else until college. And then right after I got out of college, I started writing Westerns because I saw a wonderful market for them, with especially pulp magazines and also Saturday Evening Post and Collier's. The bigger pay magazines were always running Westerns. I finally did sell one to the Post, but I sold, while I was working at an ad agency, I sold at least 30 short stories, and most of those were to the pulp magazines, Dime Western and 10 Story Western, like that. They paid 2 cents a word. 310 to Yuma, I got $90 for, but it was made into two movies.
Correct.
I still didn't make any money off them.
You mentioned All Quiet on the Western Front. Did the film inspire you to read the book, and were there other examples of that you saw a movie and you wanted to read it?
Well, it was... I think in 35, it was in the Detroit Times, the whole book,
mm-hmm.
probably over several issues, you know.
Right.
And I remember lying on the floor reading it in our living room and thinking, God, this would be a good play. And I don't know why I thought a play. You know, it's probably the only time in my life I ever thought in that way about a play, because I certainly haven't thought about it lately.
You never wrote any more plays after that?
No. Mm-mm.
Did you ever see the film Rushmore?
That sounds familiar.
Wes Anderson?
Oh, yeah.
There's,
I'm not sure if I did, though.
Well, there's a scene where it's set in a private high school, and the lead character does stage versions of movies, and one of the movies he stages is Out of Sight.
Really?
Yeah, he does the trunk. You see the trunk scene.
Oh.
You can add that to your rental list.
You know, people, directors who were thinking about doing that one, that they said, God, that's a great scene, in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, the one who finally did it, Summer...
Soderbergh.
Huh?
Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah. Anyway, he said, I want to do that scene screen black. I said, why? I think you'll lose a lot of your audience. Well, he didn't do it that way, but there were so many different ways of doing it that everybody liked that scene.
Well, going back to movies you watched younger, was there ever a film that you read the book and then you saw the movie and you thought, what in God's name did they do? Because it seemed like that happened to quite a bit of your work in the future.
Yeah, it has. No, I don't recall looking at them that way.
Okay.
No. But I wanted to write movies immediately because I wanted to make money. That was my whole idea of getting into writing and developing a particular style that I liked. And selling to the movies had to be, and I did. I saw, it's 1953, I saw my first one, which was 310 to Yuma.
What happened? They called you and they offered and that was it?
My agent. I had an agent and he called me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And what did you think of the film?
It wasn't 310 to Yuma. I wrote it in 53, but it didn't come out until 57.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed there were two titles, Moment of Vengeance and The Tall T, I believe, before 310?
Moment of Vengeance was a TV thing. Well,
I
that was in the Saturday Evening Post, a short story,
mm-hmm.
and then it was on the Schlitz Playhouse, and it was okay, you know, wasn't anything special, but the first one was the first movie was The Big Bounce, and I remember saying to my agent, I said, this is the second worst movie I ever saw, and then they remade it, just like 5 years ago.
Yeah, I remember.
And I said, well, now I know what the worst movie is. They didn't seem to know what they were doing. They shot it in Hawaii. It took place up in the Thumb area of Michigan.
I know within 310 to Yuma, and I know you also Hombre was later made into a movie.
Yeah, about 67, I think it was.
Did that one fare any better for you?
Oh yeah, I liked Hombre a lot. Didn't get a very good review in Time Magazine or Newsweek, but I loved it. I thought it really worked. And I remember in the theater, everybody in the end, Newman is shot at the end of the picture, and then the end credits come on, and everybody just sat there. because they didn't believe anybody would shoot Paul Newman or he would die in a movie, you know.
And for that time, Newman was also one of the, you know, the time-honored tradition of the white man playing Indians.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, I read that, I think your first screenplay credit was The Moonshine War?
Yeah.
How was that experience, and how did it come about?
It was about a guy who made whiskey in Kentucky in 32. It was against the law, of course, and he kept it hidden. And the revenuers are always looking for his whiskey. And finally, I don't really remember what the story was, but it was not a good movie. I just I saw it a couple of times, and that was it.
It seems like when you wrote a screenplay, did you approach it any different than, say, writing one of your novels?
No, I approached it, though, as though I were adapting the novel. I mean, I didn't look for any other ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they seemed to me always to make sense, that they would make good pictures. I remember I did one, God, I forgot what it was, for TriStar. The one that I did for TriStar, I remember I went to a meeting there, and these three guys were sitting at a table and looking at me, and the guy in the middle said, "Well, all you did was turn the book into a screenplay." I said, "Yes, that's what I did." And he said, "Well, hell, anybody can do that. You know, you just use the film way of writing instead of prose." This is where I saw that. I hadn't thought of anything new and different to put in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it was necessary. And that's when I began to realize I should not be writing movies. So finally, in 93, I quit.
Now, I can't remember. Was Mr. Majestic a novel first and then a film, or was it the other way around?
It was a screenplay first.
Okay.
And then I remember my agent saying, "You're going to have to add a lot of descriptions to make this book length." I said, "No, you add a lot of dialogue. You add it going down, up and down, not across, you know."
Mm-hmm.
So that worked fine. I'm still getting residuals for Mr. Majestic. What was that? That came out in 73.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like, you know, 40-something years later.
If you don't mind me asking, are you getting a number of checks for different films? I know, or if not all of them.
Well, I'm always surprised when one that's not very good, the Moonshine War, I'll get you know, $100 or $123 for that, or one I did for Eastwood, Joe Kidd.
Mm-hmm.
I'll finally get a residual for that one, which was not a good movie at all. I listened to the director.
What did he tell you?
Well, he said, this guy who is your bad guy, he said, I think he should be a good guy. He should be, well, once you get rid of your bad guy and he's going to turn out to be good, then who's the bad guy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, then I have to name somebody who worked for him. And it was just too contrived.
It seems like for a long, long time that directors didn't know what to do with the screenplay, or, as you said, rewrote it themselves.
Yeah. Well, directors do a lot of rewriting.
Even though you get a credit, I think of, and say what you will about the film Stick, it did inspire me to start reading your novels. I will give it that. Yeah. I was a Burt Reynolds fan, and I saw the film, and then I read the really scathing reviews, and I remember, what was it, Newsweek, I said that Burt Reynolds took an Elmore Leonard novel and turned it into a Mickey Spillane film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I had some friends that said, "Look, if you should really read his novel and check out what happened." And
yeah.
And I remember reading it going, "How could you drop the ball on this?"
Well, the first thing he said was, Burt, he mm-hmm. said, "I thought I'd leave my hairpiece off for this one." I said, "Yeah?" But what he meant was he would wear a much smaller hairpiece that looked like he had just gotten a haircut or something.
Uh-huh.
But it was his kind of a picture. It was he always made the scenes bigger than they were in the book. if there's a party at on a lawn party at someone's house where there were maybe six people there. Well, he brought in 100 people, and then he has boats passing in front of them with all lit up. You know, he's that old school of let's add more to it. If it's a movie, you know. That was a terrible movie.
Did I hear you? Do you? I remember reading in an article once that you had the poster in your office and you changed the tagline from the film.
Oh yeah.
The only thing you couldn't stick to was the script.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you still have that?
No, it was in the bathroom.
So you have? Dare I say that you have posters that are
no,
in certain
I don't
rooms?
Have any in the house?
Okay, I was saying. Say it sounds like the bathroom reflects the product.
Yeah, my barber has about a half dozen of them on his walls.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I'll have to find that.
Good too.
And it seemed so. Finally, in the '90s, it seemed like you had a good streak with Get Shorty, Jackie Brown, and Out of Sight. What do you think happened, or were people finally starting to appreciate your work?
Well, it took me a long time to be discovered. I was writing I started in the '50s. 60s, 70s. It wasn't until 85 that I hit the bestseller list, the Times list.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was a New York Times review where I was discovered. The guy says, "Hey, this guy, I think he's writing better than anybody I can think of." You know.
But I know Get Shorty, I think, was the first of them. Do you remember being approached by Barry Sonnenfeld to have that film made?
I heard that Travolta was going to be in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my agent, I said, "God, don't sell it. Don't sell it." Because he was in Look Who's Talking. I thought, I don't think he's the guy for this one. But it turned out he was. He was good in it.
Well, and he had just come off of Pulp Fiction, and I remember seeing interviews with Quentin Tarantino, who was praising your work to everybody who would listen.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember, I think in Rolling Stone magazine, the review started with the fact that Quentin Tarantino, no, that Elmore Leonard was writing Pulp Fiction long before Quentin Tarantino ever uttered his first F.U.
Yeah, he was a big fan from the beginning.
When did he start getting in touch with you about adapting Rum Punch?
I only talked to him two or three times on the phone, and he told me that he was going to cast Robert, what was his name?
Forster.
Yeah, Forster. I said, "Robert Forster? He hasn't been in a picture in 20 years. He was in that something in Chicago during the convention."
Oh, medium cool.
Medium cool.
Yeah.
Right. And he says, "Oh, no, he's good." Well, and he didn't tell me, though, that he was also casting Pam Grier. But I was, whatever he wanted to do was okay with me because I always liked his stuff.
So, yeah, you were a fan of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
It's funny. I interviewed Fred Williamson many years ago, and he worked with Forrester in many films. And his joke complaint was he had Forrester play that character for years, and then he works with some other director and gets a nomination for it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think Tarantino's adaptation was probably the closest of any picture that was made of mine.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I suppose, once he cast Pam Grier, then he's on his way. He knows who the girl is, and she's the main character.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the story. It was my story all the way.
Is that your favorite of the group, as if you have favorites?
I think that might be.
You get executive producer credits for some of these films, like Jackie Brown and Be Cool and Kill Shot and Justified. Is there any input, or did they just throw you that title?
I think I was just given that, yeah.
And I know I read on IMDb you have a production credit for apparently pre-production for Freaky Deaky. Do you know anything of that?
We haven't made it yet, have we?
No, it says pre-production.
Oh, pre-production. No, I don't know who's doing it.
I'm not at my computer right now, but I can check later and tell you. But that's just something, a piece of information I got off the internet.
Yeah.
Of all the films, what actor captured one of your characters the best?
I suppose Travolta.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, because I was surprised. Because when I told my agent that, God, don't sell it to them, then I found out that he was in Pulp Fiction, was just released then. And I got to see it, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm glad he's in it, because he was perfect.
I say, have there been any films that you've watched recently? I don't know how often you go to the movies. I was just curious.
Well, I get them now.
Okay.
Because, you know, the Oscars. I get them all.
Did your votes win?
I thought the King's Speech would win, or the other one with that Sorkin wrote. I like Sorkin's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a great script. And I thought it's between those two.
Right.
But I was happy with the King's Speech because I liked it a lot.
Yeah, me too. I have a Michigan question because you set Killshot in Algonac, or part of it in Algonac. What brought that on?
Well, I don't know. I suppose just to do it, set it locally. Maybe I couldn't think of anywhere else.
I only asked because I have friends that live there, and I remember giving them a copy of the book as a gift, and they were quite tickled.
Oh.
Did you like that film version at all?
Oh, it was, I thought it was disappointing to me that they didn't end it the way the book ends,
mm-hmm.
where she shoots the guy, you know, and leaves it up to her husband, because he was kind of, he didn't have much of a part in it at all. And the fact that they were breaking up at one point, I thought it was just thrown in for plot, because in the book, they are in love with each other,
mm-hmm.
seriously, and they'll get into fights, into arguments, but it's over in a moment, you know.
And I remember when you spoke at Butler that was the ending for the second 310 to Yuma changed at the last minute.
I don't know. I think it because the writers. I did speak to the writers, and they were here doing another one. They said we didn't understand it, but the director wanted. Who was the guy? Who was the head hero?
Russell Crowe, Christian Bale.
Yeah, Russell
okay.
Crowe. They wanted him to shoot his own guys and then get on the train, and they wrote it that way, and it didn't make any sense to me, nor it did to them, but they did it. I don't know what it meant.
If you don't mind me asking, how far are you into your new project?
I'm on page 272.
You just write until it ends?
I don't know how it ends yet, but I want to end it in about 30 or 40 pages.
Okay.
So I've got to think about how to end it.
What's the earliest you've ever written something and you knew how it was going to end?
It was Valdez is Coming.
Really?
Yeah, because I knew that one. I thought of it, and I remember calling my agent in Hollywood saying, I've got one for, and let's see, who was it going to be? I forgot the producer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you get a producer in the office, and I'll sell it to him in 10 minutes. And he said, kiddo, write your book. But I did it in about 7 or 8 weeks, which is the fastest I've ever written a book.
Did you envision Burt Lancaster?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You did?
Yeah.
Because he had a couple of interesting Westerns at that time as well. There was also Lawman and Ulzana's Raid, and I thought they were pretty dark Westerns for that time.
Yeah, especially Ulzana's Raid, yeah. Yeah.
Some people have written and some people have rumored that the Shorty in Get Shorty was inspired by Dustin Hoffman. Do you know if that's true?
Well, no, but he was up for playing the part at
I
one
see.
Time. And I said, the guy isn't that short. Because Get Shorty was just get this guy who was a popular star, you mm-hmm. know, that's all. And a lot of them are short. So, and that's why.
Well, I'm 5'5". They seem okay to me.
Oh, good. But I don't know. Get Shorty just sort of came along as a title.
Okay.
And I didn't really, I didn't start with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because then when they got to Travolta, well, who's Get Shorty? Well, then at the very end, the woman production worker says, they're all short. You shoot up.
Back in the days when you also put them on a box in a kissing scene.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I just remember reading a long time ago, I think for a brief period, that Hoffman was linked to a film version of La Brava, which never happened.
Yeah, we spent a year with him.
Oh.
Yeah, and with him and with directors. Scorsese was the first one, and then Ulu Grossbard, and then different, there were a couple of others. And we would, Walter Mirisch, who was going to produce it, he and I would go to New York and just sit and wait for the meeting to have a meeting. And then Dustin would come over and we'd talk about it. And then he said, no, then he would change the storyline. Well, where's my girlfriend? I don't have to have a girlfriend in this, you know, things like that.
Did he also order off the menu?
Always did that, yeah. That's where I got that.
I would say that captured a lot of business deals, it seems like.
Yeah, and they also don't know their zip code or their phone number if they're staying somewhere else.
Oh, wow. I say, if you're ever channel surfing and one of the films based on your books come on, do you watch it, or does it depend on how good or how bad it is?
Well, no, I don't necessarily watch it. No.
Okay.
Uh-uh.
Well, it seems like, especially with your body of work, there's always a lot of what could have been, especially with the body of work that you've put out over the years.
Well, we're still at it. We're still trying to sell them, because there are a bunch of them that we like, that we think would make very good movies, and... You know, nothing's happened because the studios just aren't as active as they used to be. That's the trouble. But we've got some that I think Swag. We've got a script for Swag. Then Sparks, which was a short film.
Mm-hmm.
Sparks is now being written for FX. They're gonna try that one. Cuba Libre, I think we've got to sell that one. That's a big picture. The Hot Kid, Tishomingo Blues would be a good movie.
Well, there's always possibilities.
Oh yeah, always.
I say, are you familiar with a website called The Onion?
No.
It's a satirical newspaper, but their entertainment section, they do real writing. I mean, the news articles are jokes, but they actually have a serious. Entertainment section, and every week they have a column called Gateways to Geekery, and what they do is they pick out like a 101 course on how to start with a particular filmmaker or a particular writer or a particular musician, and last week you were the subject. And they recommended Out of Sight as a good first step into checking out your body of work. So good things are written about you on the internet.
Well, I see the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know it was on the internet because I don't have a computer.
You don't write on a computer?
No, I write in longhand.
Yellow pads and then typewriter?
It's an unlined yellow pads that I have made. They're 8.5 by 11 unlined yellow, and I've been using them ever since I was with an ad agency where we use these kinds of pads. So I order them. I order 63 pages to the pad, and then I get 100 pads.
How long would that last?
A year. No, not 150. 50,
okay.
50 pads.
You can make a commercial with those and get an underwriting.
Yeah.
Your own brand of pads.
I go through a lot of pages, you know, because it takes me anywhere from three to sometimes five, just to get one clean page. Because I'm not sure what the scene is, you know, until I get into it. But I've been doing it for 60 years, and I have a good time. So
if it ain't broke.
Yeah, right.
From 2011, my epic chat with the great Elmore Leonard, I just, it tickles me, one, he let me do a show intro,
And the fact that I told him that The Onion had written about him, the AV Club had written about him, and he couldn't have cared less. It was great. We are in the tail end of film sociology. As I mentioned before, Sammy Terry is got all sorts of shows coming up. Just a reminder, he will be at 6 o'clock tonight on Saturday, if you're listening on Saturday. He's at the Bloomington Starlight Theater, a drive-in. And then Indiana Landmarks stage show and the screening of Frankenstein at the Indiana Landmarks on October 26th, at the Moonlight Drive-In on October 27th, at ISU on October 29th, hosting the stage version of Frankenstein. And, of course, you can go on YouTube, or I'm sorry, you can go onto Sammy's page or his Facebook page on Halloween night at 8 o'clock. And with that in mind, courtesy of YouTube, thanks, YouTube. Here's this.
In the dead of night, when the moon is high and the ill winds blow, and the banshees cry, and the moonlight casts an unearthly glow, arise, my love, with tales of woe.
Good evening. Welcome to two maddening hours of horror and fright. I am Sammy Terry. Every night is forbidding in black. The long, dark shadows set apart from the rest of the inky night by silvery pools of light from the cold, frosty-looking moon. And on certain evenings such as this, your mind can stray from the path of reality and lead you into a maze of suspicion and fear. For behind every bush and tree, hiding in the haven-hued shadows, a fiendish maniac is waiting just for you. He'll pounce on you out of nowhere and with insane fury ravage you, while a twinkling star in the heavens appears to be coming closer and closer. It isn't a star, it isn't an airplane, no, it's not a comet or a meteor. It might be a UFO from outer space bent on destroying you. You run madly home, pursued by these treacherous demons of the imagination. And when you're safe inside, you're afraid to take a drink because a deadly virus may be in the water. So hide back in the farthest corner of the couch and turn on the TV. And after an evening's imaginative stroll with terror, it'll be nice to see something soothing to your nerves. Something like my tale of terror tonight.
There you go, old school Sammy Terry. And I know you can't watch it because it's audio, but when you see this on YouTube, never forget, ladies and gentlemen, that was a single take. They kind of did that back then. We still got a few minutes, so I'm going to share. This is what I grew up with in Flint, Michigan, on Channel 2 on Saturday afternoons. Here's Sir Graves Gasly.
Ah! That sounded good. Brief and to the point. Oh, good afternoon, dear heart. Welcome once again to that ghastly production Sir Grave presents. I am your friendly neighborhood vampire, Sir Grave Ghastly. Each Saturday at this time on your TV, too, I bring you tales of the supernatural, ghost stories, monster tales, stories to chill your blood, tales to run fingers of fear up and down your spine. So, my dears, turn out your lights, pull down the shade, draw the drapes, cuddle up in your favorite spot by the telly, and glue your little eyes to your TV screen for today's tale of terror. Yeah!
Anemic, are you still awake?
Yes, Mommy.
How many times have I told you not to call me Mommy? I'm your mummy.
Okay, Mommy. Will you tell me a bedtime story?
Oh, all right. Once upon a time, there were three bats. A papa bat, a mama bat, and a baby bat. They lived in a beautiful cemetery, and one day they went out shopping at the blood bank. While they were gone, a little girl named Goldie Lockjaw got lost and was very, very tired. She came upon their tomb and went inside and fell fast asleep. When the three bats came home, the papa bat said,
"Someone's been sleeping in my nest."
And the mama bat said, "Someone's been sleeping in my nest." And the baby bat said,
"Someone's been sleeping in my nest and must have poured the poison ivy."
So the three bats ate up the little girl and lived happily ever after. Now open your eyes and go to sleep. And tomorrow you can see your favorite television show, Bat Monsterson.
Good night, Mommy.
Good night, whatever you are.
There you go. From There was also some drag on that show, but anyway, nothing wrong with that. That's Sir Graves Ghastly from Channel 2 CBS in Detroit back in the 60s until, I believe, the late 70s, early 80s. So anyway, enjoy your local horror show hosts. It is a lost art, so we should be grateful for having somebody like Sammy Terry in the Indiana area. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. If you can make it out, Dracula is at Richmond Civic Theater tonight at 7:30 p.m. and then next Friday and Saturday evening at 7:30 p.m. as well as 2 p.m. on Sunday the 28th. You can go to gorct.org for tickets. Thanks for listening. Next week we might do one more archive show and then we'll catch up on a bunch of titles. So, yeah. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!